This message is part of the educational ministry of Columbia International University. We've been preparing world Christians to know Him and to make Him known since 1923.
My name is Alex Njimana, and I was born and raised in the country of Rwanda. How many of you think I have an accent? Awesome. I see hands. Should I put my hand up or should I not? As Adam said, I grew up in Minnesota when I came, but I've been in Boone, North Carolina now for about 2 weeks. No, 2 years, and I've come. My Rwandan accent is a given, so that's gonna be with me the whole time. But you realize I use "so." That's a Minnesota thing. So if you go to Minnesota, you'll hear people say, "Oh yeah, don't you know?" Then I've come to the South, so I'm learning Southern. So, what's up, y'all? That's all I have. That's my Southern accent. I'm still learning a little Southern. So maybe some of you can teach me before we head out. But I just want to thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to share with you. And I hope and pray that as you hear my testimony, that you may not see me, but you may see what the Lord has done, that you may see yourself in it. As a little boy, many of you know of Rwanda, how Rwanda was divided into three tribes. And a lot of the two tribes, the Hutus and the Tutsis, would go against one another, killing one another. When Rwanda was colonized, they would measure the length of your nose to figure out what tribe you were. If you are very tall and you're very slim, that means you are a Tutsi. And if you're very short and you're very muscular built, that means you're a Hutu. So things they made up to divide the people of Rwanda. Once the division happened, my family fell into on the Tutsi side, and that's when my grandmother, growing up, she would just face a lot of hostility. You would come to a school like this, and they would take roll calls according to what tribe you were. So if you are a Tutsi in a class of one Tutsi in a class of 30 Hutus, and then you'd feel left out. So that continued to happen, that segregation continued to happen until 1959, when a lot of the Tutsis fled the country. And my grandmother continued to face this, but the big genocide many of you know of is the 1994. You probably have seen a movie about it or read books about it in your classes, or maybe still see clips from what happened during that time. But at this point, I was 6 years old, and I was living with my grandmother, and we're living in a very small little house, probably half the size of this stage. And my whole family were Tutsis, and the whole neighbors knew of the history of my family. But as a six-year-old, being raised by my grandmother, who loved me very much, my grandmother had faith, and her faith was my faith. And everywhere she went, I followed. If my grandmother was lazy, I was also lazy. If she went to church, I went to church. But what happened is that on April 6, 1994, when the Rwandan president was assassinated, that's when all these the militias started killing all the Tutsis. And in the morning on the 7th, we woke up and we realized we were hearing a lot of noises going on from a distance, and we were wondering what they were. It happened to be bombs going off from a distance, and our neighbor came to us and said, "Hey, do not leave this place, because if you stay here, do not leave this place. You need to go and hide, because if you stay here in this house, the militias are going to come and they're gonna take your lives." So my grandmother, who had faced all this hostility over the years, just sank into worry and almost depression, because she knew that she may not survive this. So she told us to go and hide. We hid for that day, and it was late afternoon that we would come back to our house, and we would realize that there were some noises around our house, and we got so scared, and these militias came and blew the door off the house. And they would tell us to go, all of us, to go outside and lie down. And while we did what they told us to do, that's when they would yell at me and my brother and my sister, who were young, and we went back into the house. And that was the time they took my grandmother's life. And I was wondering, why would a neighbor, why would a person who I knew, who I went to school with their children, would do this to my family? And so they left, and a week later, these men would come and would with their weapons, and they would look for my uncle. Now, their tactics during the war was, let's wipe out the young generation, let's wipe out the foundation of the family. So if you were the head of the family, they came after you. And one of my uncles was known to be the head of the family. And so they would come and they would look around and they wouldn't find him. We hid him under the bed. And while we were under the bed, he was under the bed, they would throw their weapons under the bed and they couldn't get to him. But what happened, he had pulled himself on the springs of the bed, so that when they were throwing things under the bed, they couldn't get to him. So they left. But 3 days later, three men with their guns came and said, he's under the bed, let him get out. And they did not know whether he was bluffing or not. And so he hesitated to come out, and he heard them say, if he does not come out, we're going to destroy the house. And the moment they're about to open a grenade to throw into the house, and that's what the last words he says were, please do not destroy my house. My children need a place to live. And so he came outside, and they would ask for his identity card. Now, at the age of 18 and older, you had to have this ID, and it said what tribe you were. And of course, if you're a Tutsi, no question. And if you're a Hutu, they would leave you alone. And so, of course, they would also take his life, and it would all, again, my brother and my sister and I, just in tears, wondering why would these people do this to us. They would leave again, and the other uncle we're left with would leave us alone in the house, and would wonder, he was just leaving us alone, and we didn't know what he was doing, and he would come late in the afternoon, and we wonder, why would he leave us alone and seeing what had just happened to our uncle and our grandmother? Little did we know that he was actually protecting us when he left the house. He would bribe these militias. He would buy them beer, and when he had no money left in his pocket to bribe them, that's when he came to us and said, you need to go into the city. I don't care where you go. You just maybe go into the city and live with your aunt. But if you stay here, they're going to come back, and I cannot stop them. So we packed up, we walked into the city. While we were walking, it's every 5 miles or so, there would be a roadblock. And this roadblock, there's these militias, and they would call us over, and they would point their weapons at us, and they would say, turn around. And we would be in tears. Several times, this would happen until we got into the city. We lived with our aunt, and while we were living with our aunt, life there wasn't any easier either. The water supply had been destroyed, so the whole community was using oil to cook. So life was miserable there. But my aunt and her husband came up with this idea of selling local beer in the living room. I joke today that they were making a living on selling banana moonshine because they had to do what they needed to do to protect the family. We were about 19 relatives that had come into the city to live with them. So let's say the podium is the living room. So these militias would come in the living room and they would buy whatever they wanted, and the whole family would go in the backyard. One day this man comes in the backyard, not comes into the living room, gets whatever he wanted, and he snuck into the backyard and where the family was, and he took his weapon, and he's yelling at us and said, everyone, lay down. And the process of loading his gun, his magazine fell out of the gun, and his gun jumped up, and he couldn't shoot. And in that moment, that's when my cousin comes in the backyard, and he sees what's going on, runs in the house, calls the dad, and when the dad came, he said, what are you trying to do with my family? And the guy said, I was just joking. I was just playing with them. But he wasn't there to play. He wasn't there to joke around. If his gun would be loaded, I would not be standing in front of you today. So many incidences happening that I could have lost my life. And everything that's happening in my life at this point was coincidence. Because everything was happening so quick, and I never saw God work, because my little faith that I had was my grandmother's. And since my grandmother wasn't there anymore, my faith was also not there. And so eventually we had to pack up everything. The city got worse, and we ran for a period of 2 months. And while we're running, I will never forget how God saved my life in a very humorous way. a very funny way. And again, I didn't see him work. I was running and I could hear. Now, to give you an idea, if you ever studied the history of Africa, part of it is desert, and you know, part of it is hills and mountains. So Central East, Rwanda is a tiny country in Central East, and a lot of mountains there were known as the land of a thousand hills. So we were climbing hills after hills, we're running, and while we came into this valley, I got to separate from my family a brief moment. And in that moment, I heard a noise coming from a distance, and I did not know what the noise was. This noise was getting louder and louder and closer. And all of a sudden, I slipped and fell. In the process of me falling down, that noise touched the hairs of my head. I realized I had slipped. The noise was a bullet and missed my head by an inch, and had slipped in a cow pie. And that's what the Lord used to save my life. I never thought that I would be telling people that God used the cow pie to save my life. But I'm glad he did. Why do I tell you that? Do I tell you that to gross you out? No. I tell you that to show you the power of God and what he can do. He uses something very simple, something very insignificant to save someone's life. And there are so many things that happen in our lives that he is using to save our lives each and every day. And he's a powerful God who works in mysterious ways. He works in gross ways too. But sometimes we don't see the gross part. We just want to look for the good stuff. What is the cow pie in your life that he's using? Something very insignificant that he's using to save your life today or every day. I hope and pray that you can see that and be thankful for that. But after that moment, I was put in a camp. We were put in a camp by the people who came to stop the genocide. And while we're in this camp, that's when they said, you need to send two people back into the city and to check if your house is still there, because a lot of the infrastructure had been destroyed. So when we got into the city, me and this relative, we got into the city, we checked everything, and we found had broken all the windows of the house, so we cleaned. And our neighbors, who we thought were good people, we hang out with them, not knowing anything. But that night, they would come to attack us, and what saved our lives was that I had cried and cried a couple minutes earlier that I wanted to go to use the bathroom outside. And when I went into the bathroom, that's the same time they also broke into the house, and they couldn't find us there. So miracle after miracle. But eventually, after the war, I was put in an orphanage by my remaining aunt. And when I got into the orphanage, she also passed away 3 months later. And at this orphanage, that's when all of us were just lost. 250 children living in a facility that was built for 60 people to live comfortably. And the countrywide, there was about 400,000 orphans left by the war. And over a million people literally butchered to death in a matter of 3 months. And in this orphanage, life was so tough because in the night, now that all of us were not running for our lives, we have time to process. So what happens with the process at this time, we process in the form of post-traumatic stress, because a lot of the kids are going through their mind. And in the night, people are screaming because they're just reliving the horror they just went through. But one day, we were told to line up in the yard. They said, today is a special day. Today, you're going to get a gift. And when we lined up, many of us were very impatient, wanted to be first in line. So I'm 7 years old at this point. And at this time, they said this gift came from America. Now, we could not even understand how far America was right after what just had happened. But what I learned that Samaritan's Purse had come in Rwanda to respond to the crisis that was happening in the country, and they wanted to do something. They were doing, their World Medical Mission was doing, was treating wounds, and their mentorship was helping the people who are going through the stress, the post-traumatic stress, and they wanted to do something for the orphans. And that's when one of their biggest projects, which is Operation Christmas Child, and they told us to line up, and they hand out these gifts. But they told us not to open the gifts until 250 of them have been handed out. Now, give or take, how long does it take to hand out 250 shoeboxes? About 5 minutes? Now, to a 7-year-old, that's about how many minutes? About 5 hours. But We were so excited to open that gift for the very first time in my life, I was receiving a gift. And so imagine a child receiving a gift for the very first time, the excitement that we had. We were screaming out of excitement, not because someone was chasing us, but because we could not contain our joy. And as I opened my gift, I saw the school supplies, the hygiene items, the little toy cars, and the little paintbrush. But there were so many items in that shoebox that were also a mystery to us, such as Smarties. Now, Smarties, we did not know what Smarties were, so we thought the Smarties were medicine. So, because if you look closely, Smarties, if you take one by one, what do they look like? Pills, right? So we thought the Smarties were medicine, and we'd throw them back in the box. But another item that was my favorite was a hair comb that I kept for the longest, actually, or I kept it for 3 years. Everywhere I went, I had that hair comb in my pocket. But my favorite item of all the items on that box, it was something red and it was white. Now, to a seven-year-old, I was just trying to figure out, what in the world is this? Is it edible or not? So we took the risk. I took the risk and ate this item, only to realize that it was actually wrapped in plastic. So I ate it with the plastic on it for the first time. That was my first time eating a candy cane. So up to today, I still remember, every time I say candy cane, I remember my Operation Christmas Child shoebox. But someone asked me one day, Alex, tell me, what was the experience of tasting a candy cane for the first time? And the best way to describe this is one of my favorite moments is, have you seen on TV that commercial for York Peppermint? Yeah, York Peppermint commercial, the lady bites the peppermint, what happens to her eyes? And then then they take the camera off her eyes. What happens to the skin? Goosebumps. That was my experience eating a candy cane. That's the best way I can describe it. But that moment really brought joy to my life. And receiving that gift planted seeds of hope and love that I did not see at that moment. But it was a year later when I joined the African Children's Choir. And I was in Uganda learning English and for the very first time and learning the songs I was going to sing when I come to the United States. But while I was in Uganda, God started to challenge me. Because at this point, I was asking myself, why me? Why did God create me? Why did I survive this war? Out of a million people that lost their lives, why me? When I walked right through it, I was so guilty of being alive. And I did not understand why a God who loved his people, a God who created all of us in his own image, why would he watch while a million of his children are being killed? And if he loved me personally, why would he watch while my grandmother and my uncle are being killed in front of me? And as a nine-year-old, now, I was starting to read the Bible in a different way. And I was trying to find something to put hope in. And I never forget reading the Bible in a deeper way and understanding that he had a plan for my life. And now, many of you probably have read this verse, but I want to read it to you, and I give you the context that I read it in. So I'm 9 years old. I do not know the history of the Israelites. I do not understand who God was talking to, but I never doubted that the Bible was in the Word of God. I knew that it is the Word of God for sure. And as I read, this is what I read. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans of welfare and not of evil, to give you a future and the hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will hear you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. That's Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 11 through 13. Now, many of you know that verse, and if you've seen it, maybe used out of context. And that's why I wanted to explain to you how God used those words to really communicate to me the plan he had for my life. When you read the Word of God and you don't even understand what it means, as a nine-year-old not knowing the history, I started to look at the history of the Israelites and realize that my life paralleled to their lives and how they were running away from God and being mistreated and being misplaced. But he was with them, and I realized for the very first time that he was with me from the day I was born. When I was born, actually, I could have died because my mom had AIDS, And that's how my mom died. And when my grandmother and my uncle are both killed, the distance from that drum set to where I am, there wasn't anything to shelter me from what was going on. They knew the whole family were Tutsis. They could have taken our lives. Then when I slept in a cow pie, why was that cow pie in front of me? When the man's gun didn't load, why? There's no explanation, just a split second that gun could have been gone off and all 19 of us could have lost our lives. When I ran multiple times, men, militias calling me over and they would tell me to turn around and they would never pull the trigger. From going to an orphanage and receiving a gift that reminded me to be a boy again, just exactly what I needed. I didn't need anything else. I didn't need any big things, but something to hold on to remind me that someone, that I was special, that someone was thinking about me. Why did those people pack that box? For the very first time, I saw God's presence in my life, and I could not ignore that. And that's when I really gave my life to the Lord, and I wanted to find out, what is this reason that you created me? What is this? I want to understand this love so I can share it with other people. So in this time, I came to the United States, and I traveled with this choir, and I would meet a family who would later on in 2003 bring me back to the United States. But while I was in high school, that's when I saw Operation Christmas Child, and I was so excited to share that, that story and to pack more boxes. But in high school, I did that, and then in college, we found out, I went to a small little Bible college, about 160 people. Probably all of us in this room are probably twice the number of my whole college. But they didn't do Operation Christmas Child, so we started it, but all I knew was you pack a shoebox and then you drop it off at a church and something happens in the middle, then a child receives one. I did not know what happens in the middle. Do you know what happens in the middle? It's the prayers, the volunteers around the country praying and making sure that that shoebox carries the message of love of Jesus Christ. So when I went to one of the processing centers where these boxes are inspected for things such as war items or liquids and chocolates, anything food related that could potentially spoil the box. So I saw the volunteers and I was so encouraged and I wanted to go to double the numbers of the shoeboxes we were packing in my school. So one of my favorite time of the year was when we would get together as students in my little college and we would, Adam said, I love coffee. So we would make coffee, we would make hot tea, some hot chocolate for those who don't drink coffee, and we would make some popcorn. Then we would watch one of movie classics, one of my favorite, Elf. We would watch it, and then we would pack shoeboxes. Every student would bring an item, and we would pack shoeboxes, and we would just because I knew the impact that it made in people's in children's lives, and so we would do that. And then eventually, after graduating from college, I got an opportunity to serve with a ministry in Boone, North Carolina, and that's where I am today. But I tell you that story to share with you that something very small. I don't know where you are in your lives, but something very small brings hope in the love of children. And I wanted to share with you, when these shoeboxes are delivered to children, it's not Operation Christmas Child coming in and handing out these boxes. And then we leave. This shoebox is an opportunity. When you pack it, it's an opportunity to empower the local church. We partner with the local minister, with the local pastor, a local teacher. We say, hey, we have a tool for you to share the gospel with your community. And they know their community very well. If we try to do it, we would definitely fail because we don't know the community. We're not in that community daily, but they are. And so we partner with them, and they use the shoebox to share the gospel. So that's like even today, and those partnerships go on for a long time. Today, those partners that we give those shoeboxes so they can reach the community, today are those partners who are working so hard today with the refugees in Europe that you know of. Because we already have connections, and that's why we're working. Samaritan's Purse has so many projects that they're doing, the international relief response. And those are the same partners that receive the shoebox to reach the community those are the same partners that we're working with in that local refugee crisis that's happening on in Europe. And they're the ones, because once this dies down, you know what happens? Once it's that news is off the is off on TV, that doesn't mean that everything stops. Actually, the tough life starts. But who is going to be there to help support? Yeah, the local partners that we continue to work alongside with. And so, but why do I share my story with you? There is a reason why I share my story. Why am I able to stand in front of you today and recall and just go through all that I went through? I'm not here to make you feel guilty in responding, in packing a shoebox. I'm not here to, I'm here to share with you what the Lord has done. But one day, a person came up to me and said, when after receiving the Lord Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior, I was challenged and asked, Alex, what if you would sit with the person who has caused you the most pain in your life? What would you do? Because when I gave my life to the Lord, I actually got my life turned for the worse, because everything I read confronted with what was going on in my life. Everything confronted the anger that I had in my life. And that's the anger towards the people who killed my family, who were my neighbors. And I remember when that question was asking me, Alex, tell me your story for the first time. And I shared everything, and I felt so, it was so therapeutic for me. And the chaperone continued to ask me, if you would sit with the person who has caused the most pain, what would you do? And I was so challenged, and I started to pray, Lord, help me heal to the point where I can sit with the person who has caused me the most pain. And I prayed for 12 years, asking the Lord to heal me from that. And in 2008, when I went back to Rwanda, I tried to sit with the person who has caused me the most pain, and those were the people who killed my uncle and my grandmother who were still in the prison. Well, that didn't happen, but in 2013, when I was back in Rwanda with Operation Christmas Child, we were able to go to the... It wasn't in our plan, but I figured, since I'm in Rwanda, let me try again. And it was when we went to the prison and we were able to find out that the man who killed my grandmother fled, but the person who had killed my uncle was still there. And we were able to go to this prison and we were able to... It was a divine appointment. We were able to meet with him, and I would ask him, what you did to my family? And he would say, I don't remember what I did, because so many of us did things that we were just following orders. And I asked him, do you remember us? And he would say, I remember three children being there, especially the older girl. Well, the older girl was my sister. And from that moment, I would really lose it. But in that time, I believe the Lord healed me, and my healing process is still going on today. And as I share this with you, it's part of my healing process. And I'm not here to share that with you. I'm very careful on how I share that, because I don't want people to think that, oh, look at Alex, what he did. And I share that with you because of this verse. Psalms 105, verse 11, verse 1 through 6, it says, Oh, give thanks to the Lord, call upon his name, make known his deeds among the people. Sing to him, sing praise to him, tell of all the wondrous works. Glory in his holy name. Let the hearts of those who seek the Lord rejoice. Seek the Lord and his strength. Seek his presence continually. Remember the wondrous works that he has done, and his miracles and judgment he uttered. I tell you that testimony to show you the power of God and to show you the wondrous works that he's done, not only in my life, but in your life. What is the Lord is doing? Just each and every person in this room has a testimony. Maybe your testimony is not as external as mine, where I was running away from bullets. Maybe your testimony is internal, where you're struggling with so many things. Maybe your testimony is a testimony of praise. You grew up in a Christian home, and you have you have people who love you. God, the Lord surrounded you with people who love you. That's a testimony of praise that the Lord, people need to hear. A testimony doesn't have to be a testimony of heartache. It can be a testimony of praise. But are you faithful in sharing it for the glory of God? And that is my heart, to share that. But all that you've just heard came because one person chose to do something very simple and to plant seeds of hope and love in my life using something very small. And that's what we're doing when we pack these boxes. And we never get a chance to meet the children, but I pray that one day we will see, when we sit in glory, we will see how many of these children have been impacted. In the last 20 years, there have been about 124 million shoeboxes that have been packed. And you've just heard one story. But there's way more children that have not yet received the gospel of Jesus Christ. But before we have about a few minutes, and I wanted to, we're probably not going to watch the video, but I'm going to tell you that the video is online. You can watch it if you wish to do so. But I want to ask you a question that was asked me, and that's the question: as you sit there, if you maybe were tuned out a little bit, maybe come back with me here. I've been in your shoes. Sometimes it can get long. As you sit there, think of a person who has caused the most pain in your life. Who is that person? Because you know them very well. Could be a friend who has, you know, picked on you for many years. Could be maybe that classmate in fifth grade or seventh grade that you haven't, you've always thinking about of. Maybe it could be a parent who has abandoned you. Could be maybe a boyfriend or a girlfriend who has been mistreating you. Who is that person who has caused you the most pain? Now imagine if you left those doors and you saw them, the very first person who you saw in your face like this was that person. What would you do? Your reaction would determine whether you've healed or not. And please understand, I'm not here to say that I've gotten right, because I haven't, because my healing process is still going on. I'm only sharing that with you to ask you to join me on this journey of forgiveness and living the freedom that Jesus Christ came and offered when he hung on the cross. But let me tell you, that will not happen until you let someone help you. God doesn't just, God uses people around us. And I will not be standing in front of you today without the people the Lord surrounded me with, counseling me and loving on me and showing me that love of Jesus Christ. And I hope and pray, however God uses that in your life, so be it. But you have a great opportunity to share that love with other people. But remember, you cannot share what you don't have. Thank you, and may God bless you.
We hope you were blessed by this message. Additional audio messages and learning resources are available at www.ciu.edu/bookstore or call 803-807-5263. Messages are also available by podcast at iTunes. CIU is a regionally accredited biblical university offering undergraduate and graduate degree programs. Our purpose is to educate people from a biblical worldview to impact the nations with the message of Christ. Thank you for letting us minister to you today.